This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Salim Badat for Living Islam. Today I have a guest that is I'm very happy to have, and it's been a while in the pipeline trying to get Sheikh Ismail Kamda, and we have brother Ibrahim Jadwid here. So today's discussion, we're going to talk about the Ottoman Empire, and I think that's very, very close and dear to our heart, because this is definitely the last Khilafat, you know, and after that we are lost, we don't have a Khilafat. So Sheikh, welcome to the channel. So Sheikh, just before we start, just a background of you, of your journey, and you know, where you studied.
Sure, alhamdulillah, salatu wassalam ala rasulillah. So I began my study of Islam at the age of 13, when I started the Alim course locally in Durban. I graduated when I was 20. After that, I did a bachelor's degree in Islamic studies with the International Open University. And I taught there for about 12 years. So I taught with the International Open University for about 12 years. I was the faculty manager. About a year and a half ago, I joined the Yaqeen Institute of Islamic Research in America as a researcher. Recently was promoted to the head of the books department. So alhamdulillah, I'm head of publication of books for Yaqeen Institute. And yeah, my whole life, alhamdulillah, has been writing, reading, teaching Islamic studies.
Alhamdulillah. Sheikh, yes, Brother Ibrahim.
No. It's such a pleasure to be with you and to have you with us. Mm. And the great thing is that we can agree to disagree and still be not disagreeable.
Yeah. Going to the point about why we don't know about Ottoman history. For me, it's a bigger thing than that. The average Muslim doesn't know history. The average Muslim knows Sirah and Khulafa Rashidin. And it stops there. You ask them about the Umayyads, they don't know. The Abbasids, they don't know. Ask them about Islamic Spain, never heard of it. What's Islamic Spain? They've never heard of it. The average Muslim that doesn't know that Muslims ever ruled over Spain.
Oh.
The North African kingdoms, you know, Mansa Musa, the richest man to ever live.
Yep.
Never heard of him, right? So this is a deeper problem, that we don't know our history. And it starts at a very basic level, because even in our Alim course, history is not taught. Even in Alim course, there's no subject called history. After I finished my Alim course and I did my bachelor's in Islamic studies, that's when I studied history. My bachelor's degree.
You mean in the institution, they don't teach history?
There's no subject called history. The most you learn is the Sirah and the Khulafa Rashidin. After you learn the names of the Umayyad and Abbasid rulers, but not their life stories, just their names. So
Amazing, yeah. We
don't have a history, and this is why, you know, last year I produced my own online course on Islamic history. 30 videos covering the entire history from the time of the Prophet until now, including 8 hours on the Ottoman Empire, right? Because these are things that people don't know. Alhamdulillah, the response to the series has been amazing. A lot of people have been watching and benefiting. And I focus more on the Ottoman Empire than any of the others, because it's the one we know the least about. So initially, when I was making the course, I thought I'll do maximum 3 or 4 hours on the Ottomans. I ended up doing 8 hours. Because there is so much about that history that is just a complete blank. Like, we just know after the Mongol invasion, there was the Ottomans for 500 years, and then World War I, and it's over. What happened in those 500 years, we don't know. And, you know, there are mistakes in our understanding because of that. So, for example, some of us think the Ottomans were Khalifas the whole time, or that they ruled over the entire Muslim world. Both of this is not true.
Can you elaborate?
Let me explain, right. When the Mongols invaded Baghdad and killed the last Abbasid ruler, the Muslim Ummah became fractured. In North Africa, we had the Mamluk Empire.
Yes.
Right? What the Mamluks did? The Mamluks were slaves. Slaves technically couldn't be Khalifa.
Right.
So they had one descendant of the Abbasids with them. They told everyone, oh, he's the Khalifa, we're just ruling. But that guy couldn't do anything. They were the rulers. Right, so the Mamluks were technically the Khalifas, right, ruling in Egypt. Then, in the other side, we had the Mongols themselves, who end up converting to Islam,
right.
And they became their own, sultanate.
Was it the Golden Horde?
Yeah, right. And then below that, there was the Delhi Sultanate in India.
Sure.
We don't even know about this
before the Mughals. Correct.
How many Indian Muslims heard of the Delhi Sultanate?
Correct.
We don't know about them, right? And then there was the Iranian empires as well.
Yes.
Right. And then, while all this is going on,
Empire?
The Iranian-Persian Empire.
Persian
yeah,
Empire.
Right, back
the
then.
Safavids.
The Safavids, right, the Safavids, yes. So we had all these at the same time. And while all this is happening, the Ottomans rise up. So when the Ottomans first rise up, they don't call themselves Khalifas. The Mamluks are the Khalifas. It's only after 200 years that a civil war takes place between Salim the Grim, leading the Ottoman Empire, and the last Mamluk ruler. And Salim conquers all of the Mamluk lands, which include, most importantly, Makkah, Medina, Cairo, and Jerusalem. When he conquered these four cities, then he called himself a Khalifa.
Salim.
Yes. It's only from that point onwards until World War I that the Ottomans called themselves Khalifas. But before they ruled Makkah and Medina, they called themselves Sultans. And the Mamluks were considered Khalifas. Whoever ruled Makkah and Medina were considered Khalifas. So it actually wasn't the point where the Ottomans ruled the entire Muslim world, because the Ummah was too large and too fractured at that time. You know, like, they never ruled Malaysia, they never ruled
before.
Indonesia, they never ruled India. Yeah. All of these lands had their own rulers.
But did they have? I always had the impression that all these lands of even South Africa, whoever was about Malaysia, India, Indonesia, had an allegiance to the Khalifa that was the Ottoman.
Not necessarily, because
okay.
What happened, you see, this is another myth. All of us think that from the time of the Prophet until World War I, the Ummah had one Khalifa.
Always was a Khalifa.
Technically, that only lasted 100 years.
Really? Huh?
Because 100 years after the Prophet passed away, say about 120 years after he passed away, the Abbasids came in. They massacred the Umayyads. They took over the lands.
Right.
So what they did is they invited all 50 Umayyad princes for lunch. And they had 50 assassins hiding to club them to death. One prince escaped, ran away all the way to Spain, started his own Khilafat in Spain. From that point onwards, for the next 290 years, most of the Muslim world ruled by the Abbasid Khalifa, Spain ruled by the Umayyad Khalifa.
Yes.
Both happening at the same time. Umayyad Khilafat, Abbasid Khilafat at the same time.
Yes.
The Ummah never united after that. It got splintered further. While these two are happening, the Fatimids pop up in Egypt, also claim to be the Khalifa. So now you got the Fatimid Khilafat, you have the Abbasid Khilafat, you have the Umayyad Khilafat, all at the same time. So the idea that we had one Khalifa, only the first 100 years of history.
So I've learned something here.
Look at the overall picture.
They look at the overall picture,
yeah,
but it creates an unrealistic fantasy. That's
unrealistic.
What it does. Because now you have these young guys saying, oh, we're going to establish one Khalifa and the Ummah will be united and all our problems will be solved. That's nonsense. There's never been a point like that in our history.
Mm.
Right? It creates unrealistic expectations that lead to extremism.
Understand.
That's where the extremist movements come from.
Understood. So the Mughals in India, they were regional. It was regional power. There was no
They were separate from the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah,
right? They were their own thing.
Yeah.
They were the descendants of the Mongols,
sure,
that had settled in India and had risen to power.
Sure.
So their system of rulership was completely different from the Ottomans.
Okay.
For example, in the Ottoman Empire, the Ahlul Kitab paid jizya. For most of the Mughal Empire, they didn't pay jizya.
Oh, really?
Yes. The Mughal Empire in India did not charge the Hindus jizya for most of the history.
Really? Yeah.
Right. In fact, when they tried to revive jizya, that caused a big rebellion.
Okay.
Right. So there were two different empires with different leadership methods. And that's why when the British took over India, the Ottomans didn't care.
Okay.
It wasn't their land, it wasn't their people.
Okay.
Right. So they didn't really think of it as their lands are being conquered.
How important was it for Mehmed II to conquer Constantinople? And what did it actually mean? At that very time, at that moment, at that time, in that time frame, what did it mean?
So
and I'm connecting that incident to the dua of the Prophet ﷺ. And why did the Prophet ﷺ make dua? Why was Constantinople so important at that time?
You see, at the time of Rasulullah ﷺ, the Byzantium Empire was the superpower of the world.
Right.
They were at back then like what the US is today. They were the main things.
Mm-hmm.
And Constantinople was their main city.
Right.
And it was considered a city that nobody can conquer. The Arabs and the Muslims were politically nobodies. The idea that these nobodies could conquer the unconquerable capital of the world superpower,
right,
was something that nobody could dream of.
Right.
It didn't seem possible. So for it to happen was a proof of prophethood. That's what
mm-hmm.
It was. It was a proof of prophethood. That Prophet Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam was a true prophet. That he prophesied something that seems impossible, but it happened.
Sure.
As far as the Ottomans were concerned, it was their final blow against the Byzantine Empire. Because up to that point, all of the cities and regions surrounding Constantinople had been conquered by the Ottomans. It was now one city surrounded by the Ottomans. This was the last stand of the Byzantine Empire. If they conquered the city, that's it. It's the end of 1,000 years of history.
Understood.
Well, one of the greatest empires in history finally over. So it was a major conquest for the Ottoman Empire in establishing their power in the region, showing that they're no longer nomads, they're now the superpower of the world. They have defeated the previous superpower of the world and they mean business.
Right.
So it was a major, major move for the Muslim Ummah.
So, you know, I think, the Ottoman Empire is named after Osman the First, right?
Yeah.
So just a bit about him, his father, Ertuğrul, but also the dream that he had, and his, you know, just a bit of that.
Okay. So one of the problems with early Ottoman history is that we don't really have the details, right? A lot of it, because a lot of it has been passed down verbally,
right,
in terms of legends and folklore. You know, stories that the parents told their children about the heroes. How much of that is true? We can't really know. Like, if you look at the Ertuğrul TV show, all we have of Ertuğrul in the history books is like two paragraphs. Just like maybe 20 lines or 10
Nothing.
Lines. That's all. That we know he was the father of Usman, right? We know he spent his life in jihad against the Crusaders and the Mongols.
And the Mongols.
Yes.
Crusaders and...
Yeah. And we know that his son established the Ottoman Empire.
Okay.
So what they did with the series is, okay, we have this part of our history that's unknown. We know this man fought the Crusaders and the Mongols for 20 years.
And
we don't have any details.
It.
Just make a story around
sure.
it. One season with the Crusaders, one season
sure.
with the Mongols.
Sure.
And, you know, they built an entire TV series around it. And it's there's a thing a lot of people don't realize. Ertuğrul is a historical fiction series. Lots of people think it's history. It's not history. The directors and actors will tell you it's historical fiction. Meaning it's based in history, based on real people, but the stories are fictional.
Yes.
The stories are dramas made up to entertain. And there's nothing wrong with that. I actually think it's a really good thing in our generation
yes.
that we now have Muslim fiction.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
That we now, wherever I go, I see Muslims, instead of sitting and watching all this rubbish with the, you know, the alphabet people and stuff like that,
they're
watching Ertuğrul. They're watching Osman. And it's changing them. They're learning the akhlaq from these people. They're learning the manners from these people. They're learning courage and bravery from
Absolutely.
These people. They're learning and absorbing Islamic culture from watching a TV show.
Absolutely.
Instead of learning and absorbing Western culture from watching a TV show. So it's very beneficial.
Very
we need more shows like this.
Absolutely.
We really
sure.
need more shows like this. That's for sure.
There's a show on Bilal. Did you see that on Netflix?
That new one, I didn't watch it yet. I'm very skeptical about that one. Made in Dubai.
Okay.
Lots of propaganda involved. So
okay.
I'll watch it soon. But
okay.
I've heard very
But that could go for Egypt too. You know, Egypt, Dubai and all of they have their own.
You see, the problem is that most of the, even when Muslims do end up making a TV show, there's often a lot of propaganda involved. Like currently there's one in development by some Arab countries to make the Ottomans look bad. And to make the Arabs look like heroes.
Yeah.
Now we have to see
sure.
through all
that's,
of this if you watching.
That's the reaction.
Yeah.
Sure.
That's why the Ottoman period is hidden from us.
Sure.
To hide the Arab people's collaboration with the Western world, which led to the downfall of the Ottomans.
We'll get to that definitely at the end, right? Sheikh, some important historical sultans and figures, maybe just a bit around Suleiman the Magnificent, Sultan Salim, you know, he conquered Egypt, he conquered Syria, Arabia, Palestine in a short period. Just a few of them.
Okay, so if you're looking at important members of the Ottoman dynasty, sadly, most of them are not important.
Most of them were not important.
Especially in the second half of the Ottoman Empire. After Suleiman the Magnificent, for the next 300 years, there's political instability, infighting, a lot of drunk rulers, a lot of people you don't want to talk about, right?
Mm-hmm.
We go back to the early Ottomans for the gems.
Right.
The early Ottomans is where you get the gems. You have, of course, Usman himself.
Right.
Right? This is a man who dedicated his life to jihad against the Mongols and Crusaders.
Right.
Now, what you have to understand about the Turks before Usman is that they were nomadic people. Nomads meaning they were tribes traveling from place to place, living in tents, like how you see in the series. They learned to adapt to their situation. They realized to fight the Mongols and the Crusaders, we can't be moving around in tents. We need cities, we need walls, we need, you know, protection. So they started to establish a city. And from that city, they fought off both sides. Remember, they're fighting two jihads at the same time. Crusaders on this side, Mongols on that side. Right? It's a double jihad. So they have to establish the cities with their boundaries. Others see them rising up, people want their protection. So more cities come under control, and more cities. And eventually, by the time of his grandson, it's a full country. It's like a full-sized country, because everyone sees that these people, this family, can protect us from the Mongols, and they could protect us from the Crusaders, and they are more just than both of those empires. So more and more cities are giving them allegiance, and the empire is growing like that. So that's the first important person, that's Usman himself. And yes, there's a TV show about him. And again, the TV show is highly fictionalized. There's a lot of it that's fictional. There's certain points, parts of it that I I find very objectionable, like their treatment of polygamy, right? Because, okay, let's just talk about this. Usman had two wives, right? His first wife he had his children from. His second wife was a woman he fell in love with. What the TV series, the one he fell in love with, right? The TV series, because they don't want to put too much of a good spotlight on polygamy, they stop the story around. Season one, he falls in love with a girl, marries her. Season two, she says she can't have children. She says, okay, I'll take a second wife to have children only. But I only love you. Right? This is nonsense. This is complete opposite of what happened.
Okay.
Because they don't want polygamy to be viewed, you know, positively, they went and changed the whole story.
Got it.
And this is a major, major problem. So when watching these shows, again, be careful of where they change the history for propaganda reasons, right? And make sure that you get the accurate view of the history. Another important person in the history, of course, is Mehmed II, Muhammad the Conqueror, right? Muhammad al-Fatih, because he's the one who conquered Constantinople. Now, Constantinople became Istanbul, right? And right till today, it is a major city of Islam.
When did it change its name to Istanbul?
No one really knows.
Okay.
It was like...
It was more like a slang terminology. But
actually,
I see there was like an objection to it because... And the objection was based on the premise that the Prophet ﷺ called it Constantinople. Why change it to Istanbul? So that's another issue.
The Prophet ﷺ called it Constantinople. He didn't say it religiously.
Sure.
He called it by what it was called at that time.
Sure.
I mean, then that's the case. We can't call Jerusalem, Jerusalem.
Wow.
Because at the time of the Prophet ﷺ, it had a different name.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember the name, but it wasn't Jerusalem.
Correct.
Right? But it had a Roman name at that time. But when the Muslims conquered it, they changed it to Al-Aqsa.
Sure.
Right? And then when the Jews conquered it, they changed it to Jerusalem. Whoever's ruling it is going to give it a name based on, you know, their idea. So the name, there's no...
So the capital of Alexander the Great, Alexander, is still called Alexander.
Yeah.
So Mehmed II,
So he conquered Constantinople. Now, this gave them a very strong seat of power in the world. Right. Before this, they were ruling from smaller cities.
Right.
With Constantinople, they now have one of the oldest and most historical and most powerful cities in the world as their capital.
Okay.
And this gives them prestige, not just in the Muslim world, but in the Western world as well. Because now even the Christians have to humble themselves before the Ottoman Empire because these guys mean business.
Sure.
If they destroy the Byzantine Empire, what else could they do?
You see, Maulana, there's another point that we should look at. You see, at the time of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, right, Arabia was never conquered by anybody.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to touch it.
Yeah.
Nobody wanted to have anything with it. There was no benefit in it.
Right. That's true.
As Gibbs said, the Arabs are neither reliable friends or dependable enemies. Nobody touched in their history.
Yeah.
Right. But around this Arabian peninsula was a Christian world.
Yeah.
Think about it. Where the first people went?
Abyssinia.
Christian.
Yeah.
The Christians of Najran. Yemen,
yeah,
right? The Prophet ﷺ sending a message to the Patriarch of Egypt and getting back Maria Kipti, may Allah bless her, or Jerusalem, or Syria, where Nabi Yahya is buried. So the entire world around this Arabian Peninsula was Christian.
Mm.
My point in bringing this up is that when you took it all, Maulana, when you took all of this, do you think they're going to feel nice about you? You understand?
I know what you're saying, but...
No, I mean,
I get what you're saying, but that's the history of the world.
No.
This world was conquered,
conquered.
That's how
you
wanted at that time.
To understand...
Yeah, why, how they react.
No, animosity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So this, at the time of the Prophet, there was the
I get what you're saying. I understand that's what led to the Crusades.
Yes.
Because they wanted revenge. Because that's their land.
Correct.
Like especially Jerusalem today was their land.
But all of this land...
And they invented this whole Crusades concept to get that land back.
But there was another point, This Eastern Christian Roman Empire that ruled this part of the world was shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. It ended up where? Constantinople. So the last bastion of Eastern Christian Roman Empire was Constantinople. Anyway, stop there.
So, Chris, you know, there's a conversation going on for centuries, for long. About the Turks committing atrocities, was this in Greece? Was it committed against the do you know that incident I'm speaking of?
Yeah, you see, there's two ways to look at these things. Number one, if these things happened, during a specific sultan's reign.
Sure.
It's on him, not the entire empire.
Correct.
His forefathers and those who came after him, nothing to do with it. That's his sin, his crime, and you can't say it's a whole Ottoman
and
empire.
And not all were just.
Yes, you can't, because it's 600 years of rulers.
Exactly.
You're going to get a few bad apples.
Exactly.
You're not going to have all good guys, right? I mean, even Selim the Grim himself.
Yes.
You know, we talk about him conquering Jerusalem and Makkah. And who he conquered it from? Muslims.
Right.
He fought the Mamluks.
Right.
He fought fellow Muslims to conquer their lands.
Right.
So that's not a good thing.
Sure.
But it's history. It's what happened. And one thing I believe in teaching history is you have to give the facts.
Sure.
No matter how uncomfortable the facts are, no matter how controversial the facts are facts. What happened, happened.
Tell us.
The other point I was going to mention about that is that you also have to understand there's a lot of propaganda from the other side. Right? Like in Greece specifically, there's a lot of propaganda against the Ottoman Empire to portray them as these invaders who conquered our land and oppressed us. So some of the stories will be true, some of them will be exaggerated, some of them will be false. Like we can't just accept everything that comes from them because
see,
they have an agenda behind what they're saying.
You see, Salim, the Ottomans ruled over Greece for 150 years. Right? Now, the same thing with the people that they say committed genocide. Who are they?
The Turks.
Yeah.
No. The Turks committed suicide up to now.
Genocide.
Yeah, the genocide, right. Names escape me. These are the people who even now campaign, and America supports them, to say that the Turks committed genocide. But these people, I'm just forgetting the name now, these people collaborated with the enemies of Ottoman. And there was a reaction to that. That's the problem.
So when the Ottoman Empire spread throughout Eastern Europe and throughout the Mediterranean, so it spread, meaning land was conquered, correct?
Yeah.
How did the people embrace Islam? How did Islam spread in the land? So you conquered it.
Yeah.
How does Islam spread?
So one thing the viewers have to understand is that when we talk about Islam spreading historically, we talk about two different things. The political spread, which was the jihad to conquer lands and bring those lands into the Muslim empire, right? But you have to understand, when Muslims did that, the people remained on their religion. Islam never forced anyone to convert to Islam, right? So people would pay the jizya and they remained on whatever religion they were on. That's why there are Hindus in India right today, even though Muslims ruled for a very long time, because we didn't force our religion on people. This is what people misunderstand.
Yep.
They say, oh, but you still conquered their lands. Well, everyone did that back then.
Sure.
That was the world. The world was conquer or be conquered. And the Muslims, if they didn't conquer, they would have been conquered. That's how the world was. Until, you know, the modern world and modern borders were drawn up, that's how every country operated. Right? So that's what it was. Now, how did Islam spread as a religion in those lands? One thing the Ottomans did differently from the empires before them is they developed what they called the millat system. So the millat system simply meant that every community governed themselves by their own book. Meaning, if you lived in the Ottoman Empire, you could go to a Christian town. The whole town is run by Christianity. The whole town is run by the Bible. And you go to a Jewish town, the whole town is run by their law. Right? And this was the millat system established by Ottoman Empire. Complete freedom of religion on a level that doesn't exist today.
Yeah.
Now what that did to, it led to more people being exposed to Islam. Because they can live in a Christian town, visit a Jewish town, visit a Muslim town, compare the three, and realize the Muslims have more justice, more peace, they have the zakah system, they have the okaf system. It's a very important thing to talk about, the Ottoman Empire, the okaf system, and how that made such a big difference.
Sure.
They see all of these things in place. And yeah, this is a beautiful religion, this is a beautiful way of life. And this, of course, attracted the hearts of people. And over time, people converted to Islam. And a lot of people, again, don't realize. They think Muslims enter a country and within 10 years, everyone's Muslim.
Yeah.
No, it's hundreds of years.
Yeah.
One family at a time. Naturally, organically. No one's knocking on doors and demanding you become a Muslim. It's a very organic thing. Same thing happened in Malaysia, same thing happened in India. It was a natural process of people being exposed to Islam in practice. That's
see,
what attracted people to
see,
Islam.
Morana, for example, when we took Syria, 100 years before the people accepted Islam.
Yeah.
100 years.
They were Christians for the whole time.
Right.
And there's another problem with that.
In reading the Eastern European history, the Polish poet, see the Eastern European countries, internecine wars between one church group and another church group, fighting each other. So they invited the Sultan to come and make the peace. So I must get hold of the poem. The Polish poet is writing, not until the hooves of the horses of the Sultan enter our land when we have peace. Looking forward to the Sultan's horses coming in and giving them peace.
You see, based on what you mentioned now, right, is that you have to understand Christian sectarianism was much worse than Muslim sectarianism.
Oh, too much.
Christians in those days, they would treat any other sect as like kafir. You know, they'd be just killing each other,
slaughter,
fighting each other.
Slaughter.
They couldn't handle living with another sect. Muslims, on the other hand, treat all Christians as Ahle Kitab. So they go all, if they're living in a Muslim empire, they could live side by side in peace.
Yeah.
But if they're living in Christian empires, there's going to be war.
Absolutely.
So it was better for them to live in a Muslim empire because that was the only way
Absolutely.
To actually have freedom of religion.
You know, regarding the Okaf system,
yeah.
is there something else?
You see, when they invited the Sultan, he came in and he set up an order because between one Christian group and another, giving them structure and status. Am I right, Maulana?
Yes, again, the millet system.
He gave the millet system, right. So the Christians found that the Sultan was able to solve their problem. You leave me alone.
You got your town,
you
got your town, each town is ruled by their version of Christianity.
See how beautiful
that
is. So that's why in the Eastern Europe, you see, we don't realize that these people were attracted to Islam. I mean, you look at the Bosnians, they're Europeans. Albania, 70% Muslim. Macedonia, Greece. Not Macedonia in Greece, but Macedonia, 60% Muslim. So these are Eastern European countries with large Muslim populations.
The Okaf system you mentioned, so you can maybe elaborate a bit on that?
Okay, so one of the most beautiful things about the Ottoman Empire, even the Arab empires before them, especially for the Islamic lands, was the Okaf system. So what happened with the Okaf system was, when Muslims got rich, right, they would want to invest their money in the Akhirah. So what they would do is, for example, they would start a hospital or a school or a library or a madrasa, and they would just make it waqf, waqf for Allah. So you could go anywhere in the Ottoman Empire, free hospitals, your whole hospital is waqf for Allah. Free schools, the whole thing is okaf. You know, free, all this stuff is free. There were animal shelters, okaf. You know, there were old age homes for horses, okaf. All these things were free, done by the waqf system. The British come in, they conquer these lands. They're like, you got all these things, you're not making a profit, turning into profitable hospitals, profitable schools. Now what happens? The people living in these lands are used to free education, they're used to free hospitals, they're used to all these things being free. Overnight, the British turn these things into paid expenses. They're not earning enough to pay for these things. Suddenly the economies collapse and these become poor countries. They weren't poor countries before that. The Okaf system gave a quality of life that the modern world doesn't have. That you could live anywhere. You know what they were doing in the Ottoman Empire? If you were sick, you could go to hospital. Not only was the whole thing free, they would ask you, how much money do you normally earn in this week? You'll say, like 10 dirhams. They'll give you 10 dirhams. So that you still got your money. That was the level of Okaf system they had running in the Ottoman Empire.
What
the British came in and destroyed it all.
What about the culture of learning? So we know in Spain,
yeah.
and the great scholars that came out of Spain, and we know the seat of the Renaissance in Europe,
mm-hmm.
was Spain was the catalyst. So my question is, in the 600 years of Ottoman rule, academically, culture of learning,
okay,
what
so
came
this
out
is
there?
The one area where I'm going to criticize the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
The stagnation and decline of intellectual Islam really started in the Ottoman era. Right? If you look at the Umayyad and the Abbasid empires, Muslims were the world leaders in science, in technology, in mathematics, in medicine, in fiqh, in hadith, in aqidah, in everything. They were the world leaders. They were like, you know, you had like geniuses
right.
of all these fields. What happens in the Ottoman era is that people become more caught up into following their groups
right.
and their madhabs, right? And then these groups become smaller and smaller. And they stop thinking. You know, it becomes more about you just learn whatever your teacher taught you and you teach it to the next generation.
Right.
And Islamic knowledge became narrow and narrow to such an extent in the last 200 years of the Ottoman Empire, ijtihad, I don't know if you know what ijtihad,
sure.
right? It's a scholar's process of developing new fatwas,
sure.
on the independent fatwas. Ijtihad was illegal.
During the Ottoman?
Yes. There was a point in the 1800s where mujtahids in Syria, Muslim scholars in Syria, were trying to solve the modern problems of that time. Because remember, technology was advancing, new things were developing. They were trying to solve the problems at the time of making some new ijtihads. They were arrested and sent to jail for committing the crime of ijtihad.
Right.
It got so bad that if new medical technologies were developed, haram. They're just haram. No real ijtihad now,
that
just
was,
haram.
That was so sad because you had 600 years now.
So what happens here is, this is where the real problem came in, right? While this intellectual stagnation is happening in the Ottoman Empire, at the same time, what's happening in Europe? The Renaissance.
Sure.
So they are going up while the Muslims are going down, and at some point it crosses. At some point they're going up and we're going right down. And we never made that U-turn yet where we could catch up with them.
You see, another thing, Salim, is this. When the Mongol invasion took place,
yeah.
You know this. When the Mongol invasion took place, they piled up the books 10 stories high and burned them. Right? Now, I'm trying to figure out what happened at that time. So, like today, many Muslims say, for example, say, Palestinians are not making a salah, therefore they don't have the support of Allah. Right. So, at that time, the people felt that we were so bad. So, they turned to the Musalla and the Tasbih and left that scientific Islam in the time of the Mongols. So from that moment onwards, that period developed without that original period of Islamic civilization that we had, science and technology. All of these things were stopped because Bokharab, we are bad Muslims. So let's go back to Salwa and Tasbih. And they forgot about that Islam. It's just an opinion.
So if you look at contemporary, has it affected, obviously the last dynasty that we have is the Ottoman.
Yeah.
Obviously the ramifications of that, of the closed-mindedness and of...
It's still here.
The
madrasa system they developed is the one we're still following today.
Did they develop it?
That's the one we're following today was developed in the Ottoman Empire.
Really,
huh? Because that was their education system. And I think the I don't know if the Mughals copied them or just developed the same system at the same time.
Who copied them?
The Indian Muslim Empire.
Yeah, they copied them, of course.
But the point is that system goes back to what they developed. And their system that they developed was one about basically parroting knowledge,
yeah,
rather than developing the sciences.
Rote learning.
It just became like, you know, you memorize these books, you're an alim now.
Sure.
You know, that's how it began. Like, you actually, they have TV series there about, there's a TV series about the man becoming a judge in the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah.
They give him a few hadith books and fiqh books to memorize, and he's alim, he's a mufti. Just memorize it. There's no understanding involved.
If you look at the history, if you have to go a bit deeper, right, Sheikh? I mean, I'm going a bit deeper on this. If you look at the DNA, the history of the Ottoman, right, they are from the Mongolians, right? It's part of the Mongolian, and the Mongolian wing. And the Mongolians were never known to be as thinkers or any of that, more like conquerors.
That's what I say, they burnt the books.
So you don't think that somehow...
I don't think it's related because the Ottomans, the early Ottomans were much more intellectual.
Really, yeah?
They were. Like, if you look at Suleiman the Magnificent,
yes,
he was a reader.
He was an artist.
He used to make jewelry as a hobby for his wife, for his harem of women. Right? He used to make jewelry for them as gifts. He used to read books. He used to have private historians working for him. At his time and before him, even Mehmed II, the conqueror, he was an intellectual.
But
he knew the hadith about the conquest of Constantinople, and that inspired him to conquer Constantinople.
Absolutely.
So there was an intellectual trend in the early Ottoman Empire. It was the latter Ottoman Empire,
right,
the last 300 years of the history. You see, there's so many factors to talk about. We don't have enough time. But
no,
what happened?
We'll
let
have
me mention two things.
We'll
right?
have a part two after this.
Two more things that happened in the later Ottoman history. Number one, civil wars. All the Ottomans in the later half, you'll find brother killing brother to take over as king. One guy is king for 1 year, another guy is king for 8 years, another guy is king for 2 years. There's brothers killing each other to take over as kings. So the empire is crumbling at that time. You know, when there's a civil war, there's no progress.
Sure.
Right? The other thing that happened is that they became scared of new technology. And making fatwa saying that technology is permissible. I mean, the most common example given is the printing press. I don't know if you know the story of the printing press, but the common example given by some historians is that when the printing press was developed in Europe, the Ottomans considered it haram for about 200 years. So they only started printing books 200 years after the Europeans. And they couldn't catch up.
You see, Molana, another thing is, I had the sad occasion to visit the cover of The Last Sultan. It's buried in Paris.
Right.
If you ever get a chance to go there and you collect his books, what a mind, what a great person. His khair, his understanding, the right person at the wrong time in history.
And that's the other point I want to make there is the last 100 years of Ottoman rule, there was a concerted effort to revive the empire.
Yes.
They started reformatting their fiqh, changing their government system, getting rid of the outdated things. But it was too little too late.
That's
the problem. It was too late.
Well, if you
the Europeans
see,
were now 300 years ahead of them in technology and things like that. They couldn't catch up on time, but they made the effort. They definitely made the effort, but it was too late.
But another thing, Salim, I must tell you, in spite of it, right, the Turks are part of the NATO forces, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why they make them part of the NATO forces?
That I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you, because the Turks are great fighters.
Yeah.
You see, when the First World War, 1914-1918, Ottoman joined Turkey in the hope, this is just my reading, in the hope that if the Germans won, the British, French and others would leave the Muslim lands. Unfortunately, Germany lost. But when Germany lost, it was the grab of the Muslim empire.
Yeah.
When I say the world, I mean, with exception, Iran is one of them, mm-hmm. India is one of them.
India has already fallen by them.
They all rule by
them.
But at the end of this period, 1914-19, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, 1916, where they carved up this this Ottoman Empire. You take this, I'll take that, you take this. And that's when General Allenby enters Jerusalem, right? And it's called the Allenby Bridge, even now, where he says, this day, the Crusades have come to an end. They never left it. But the last area of Turkey, including Constantinople, right, was strongly guarded by the Turkish forces. So you know the history of Gallipoli. Gallipoli was the most resounding victory of the Turks against the combined forces of France, Britain and all that. Right. Apparently a million of them died, but the Turks conquered them at Gallipoli. And every year there's a celebration marking, every year, even now, Gallipoli. Right. Before that it was the Dardanelles. In 1916 they sent 200 ships into the sea, right? The Adriatic Sea and all that, right? To try and overwhelm the Turks. But the Turks fought valiantly. So they, look, you like him or you hate him, Atatürk was the person that protected this kingdom or this area, right, East Turkey. And that's why they revere him. Because
right.
He led that fight.
Atatürk, I think, yeah, so Atatürk is an important figure in the end, right?
Yeah.
Although he did so much harm to Islam.
Absolutely. So I think, Sheikh, I think let's round it up in the next 5 minutes. I think we have 5 minutes. So round up the Arab collaboration, the Saudi collaboration with the British.
Not Saudi, whole Arab.
The whole Arab collaboration with the British. The
British,
you know,
French
the,
and all.
Yeah, but yeah.
I think the Arab topic we'll leave it for another day because that's going to take an hour.
Got
we
it.
Can't cover that in 5 minutes.
Got it. So yeah. The next one, inshallah. Right?
Sure.
So I think 5 minutes, another 2 minutes, whatever you want to,
yeah.
However
so,
you want to close it up.
One of the points I want the listeners to take from this is that when studying history, understand that history is often written by the victors.
Yeah.
So you have to be very careful the books you are reading, who wrote it, and what's the bias.
Yeah.
That's very important.
History is by the one that...
Yeah, so like for example, what's research about the Ottoman Empire come from Saudi books. And the Saudi books are full of nonsense.
Full of nonsense.
They're full of lies.
Full of lies, yeah.
Especially about Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab and what he did. They glorify it and they make him sound like he's such a nice person, he did such good things. When you read other history books written at that time by people who were alive, everyone was scared of him. All the ulama, for Hanafi, Shafi, Hanbali, everyone was scared of him. They all thought he was like some extremist terrorist type guy. They didn't see him as an alim.
But he teamed up with the political power to overpower them.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Busy man. Thank you so much for your time.